So, good morning, Dr. Grinstein. Thank you very much for sitting down with us. As we've discussed ahead of time, the general theme of these discussions are the history of reticulometry breaking in physics, which we bound roughly from 1975 to 1995. But before we get to the heart of that topic, I'd like to ask a few background questions that may enrich or contextualize that understanding. First, can you tell us a bit about your family and your studies before starting university and at McGill?
Oh, sure. Well, I was born and raised in Montreal, in a section of town called Côte-Saint-Luc, which was a young, sort of newly formed suburb. It used to be farmland, but there was this new tract of houses that young families moved into. I went to public high school, Wager High School. With where I felt, I really got a very decent education. Not sure what else you'd like to know about. I have an older sister and a couple of parents who who were alive until relatively recently.
How did you get interested in science and physics in particular, then?
Well, it was really in high school, I think. Well, actually, we had a wonderful math teacher, actually, who inspired our interest both in math and science. And he's, when I still get in touch sometimes with some of my old friends from high school, we all remember him with great fondness. Not everybody ended up in science, but a lot of them ended up or engineers, architects, etc. And without exception, they all credit him for sort of pointing them in the direction of some kind of profession that involved analytics. So I would credit him. Name was Bob Curries, by the way, with inspiring a lot of students in those days.
So what then led you to pursue a PhD in theoretical physics at Harvard in particular, and with Alan Luther, more specifically?
I guess I started out in a joint math and physics program at McGill, but it turned out that that was a 5-year program, and I was getting restless after 3 years, and I thought, well, I'd like to graduate the same time all my buddies were graduating, so I switched at some point to a pure physics major because I felt, having taken a certain amount of both math and physics, that the physics somehow suited my interests and personality a little better. So I graduated with a degree in physics, and then I was anxious to pursue those studies. So, I applied to graduate school a bunch of places. Harvard was one of the places I got accepted, and there it was. And as far as working with Alan was concerned, there were a small number. I decided quite early on, I wanted to do, did not want to do high energy physics, wanted to do lower energy stuff. Condensed matter seemed like a sort of satisfying subfield for me. And there were relatively few theorists doing that. Paul Martin, whom I'm sure you, if you don't know personally, by reputation, was there. And he was, I think. He was on leave, I think, that year when I was choosing a thesis advisor. So it made it very easy. I think Alan was just about it. I mean, there were some people doing band structure theory, and I wasn't particularly keen on doing that. So it made the decision very easy, actually. And he couldn't have been nicer and more encouraging to me, helpful. So it was a turned out to be a very good choice.
So you worked on disorder during for your thesis, and there's a few aspects of that work that I'd like to probe a bit more. In particular, you describe one of the foundational ideas in your thesis is to describe how to average over disorder in order to obtain an average free energy, which we would now call a quenched average, in statistical mechanics parlance. Do you remember where this idea originate from?
Yes, I do actually. It came from a journal club. And I was trying to remember, well, I can't remember who gave the presentation, but in the small group of students and who Alan was in charge of, and a couple of other students from with different advisors, we had a theory journal club that met once a week, and one of the students would find an interesting looking preprint and try to describe it to the rest. And one of those preprints was a work by Shankeng Ma, which was an attempt to, and the thing is, I'm not sure what the problem was that he was addressing. I think it was the localization problem, actually. But I don't have a copy of that ancient preprint, which was later withdrawn. But he, in that preprint, had this idea of using the n equals zero limit as a way of turning a quenched random problem into a translationally invariant problem. He may have gotten that idea from De Gennes' work, who had done something about the excluded volume problem using n equals zero, but I'm not sure. I can't really remember the detailed history of where his paper came from, if I ever knew it. It turned out that that paper had a serious flaw in that it produced a translationally invariant Hamiltonian that was unstable. The fourth order term had the wrong sign, and so when he realized that, and I think people realized it quite quickly, he withdrew the paper. But Alan Luther, my advisor, had this idea for a while that disordered systems ought to be able to have sharp phase transitions the way pure systems did, even though a lot of the experimental evidence at the time seemed contrary. The transitions seemed as if they might be rounded, and there was this one existing analytic calculation by McCoy and Wu, I guess it was, for a disordered system that showed that the transition looked very different. But of course, the system they studied had correlated disorder. The disorder was correlated along rows of a two-dimensional system, as I recall. And so it wasn't clear how well that would apply to systems with short-range correlated disorder. And Alan had this intuition that it ought to be possible. I'm not sure where that intuition came from. It's just a feeling he had. And so we had been talking about this a little bit and had no idea how to proceed. And when somebody came up with this preprint and talked about it, he and I, it was this, a light bulb went off in both his and my head. It was like, whoa, this, might be something that we could conceivably use to handle the problem that we were interested in. And so that's how the project got started.
I mean, did you have at any point get in touch with Ma during that work, or this was really just only through the preprint that you read?
It was just through the preprint, I think. I don't remember. Later on, he and I wrote papers together, and I would like to say a word about him, actually, if I may.
Sure.
The most delightful guy, brilliantly creative, modest, friendly. I can't say enough nice things about him. And he passed away, unfortunately, very young. I'm glad to be able to remember him as, one of the founders of this whole enterprise. And I think he was, as I remember, having gotten to know him later, he was embarrassed about that preprint. He didn't want to talk about it. He didn't want to hear about it. I think the it's just an example of how interesting mistakes can be as important sometimes as work that turns out to be correct,
The treatment of disorder in your thesis was redone and expanded by Victor Emery in a paper published in 75 and I think submitted in 74. And that paper does cite your thesis. How were you in touch with Emery and what did you think of his approach or his demonstration?
Well, it made me feel stupid because it was so much easier than what I'd done. among other things. Yeah, we were definitely in touch. I spent 2 summers at Brookhaven where he was working. So that would have been, I guess, the summer before my final year. So I guess the summer of 74 and possibly the summer of 75, and maybe 73 and 74. I'm not sure. I've got the dates 100% right. And so he and I talked a lot. You know, I told him about what we were doing. And also, he had worked very closely with Alan, who had been I think Alan was a postdoc of his, if I remember correctly, at Brookhaven. And so they were in constant touch. So I'm sure Alan was also telling him, you know, the kinds of things we were doing. And so, yeah, he got interested in it and then, you know, produced this much more elegant way of deriving the derivation of the translationally invariant Hamiltonian.
So by the time you actually wrote up the paper based on the thesis, you cited Emery's treatment. But you also cited a paper from 1959 by Brout or Brout that explains the rationale for quenched disorder. It's a footnote actually in the paper. Do you recall how you became aware of that work? Or was this, it's not cited in your thesis, but it's cited in the paper, so that's why I'm trying to.
I'm sorry, I don't. I have no recollection of that.
Beyond what Victor Emery did, what was the initial reaction to your work from the community and
That's a good question. I remember people being interested. You know, I think part of the problem was that I was very slow turning the thesis into a paper. You know, I left graduate school, I took a postdoc at the University of Illinois, and for some reason, you know, I had no idea what how this business worked. You know, I was just a kid, obviously, like we all are, you know, when we just finish up. And you know, in those days, I think students were much less plugged into the system as a system than they are now. You know, I think now people go into graduate school with a much clearer sense of how things are supposed to work and what's supposed to happen to them after they graduate. With me, I guess I was a slow learner because I had very little sense. And actually, I was a little bored with the problem myself. But after finishing the thesis, you know, I was a bit shocked that it actually worked, that you could actually, you know, get this thing to work. But I'd spent a lot of time on it, and I was kind of bored, and I was looking for other things to do. Anyway, and Alan, you know, was not either, you know, also wasn't very pushing me or very ambitious to get the paper written. So it took a long time. And so I don't think that many people were aware of it really, until a little bit later. The people who knew about it seemed excited about it, you know, I think Vic, you know, for example, and some others, but I think, and then by the time I actually got around to writing the paper, Tom Lubenski had written a paper doing similar things, doing the renormalization group with the quenched disorder itself, as you know. So, and I think, you know, certainly when that paper came out, I think people. I think there was a shift in the perception of the possibility of having sharp phase transitions in disordered systems. I mean, I think those papers did convince people. And I think too that it had an influence on the experimentalists because you know how it is. If you think there's something there, it's somehow easier to find it experimentally than if you're very unsure if you're very unsure that it's there. So I feel as if the whole field slowly, you know, it took a few years, shifted in terms of the perception of sharp phase transitions in disordered systems. And actually that I don't know if you wanted to talk about this, but that interest actually reached a fever pitch with the random field problem around the same time, where there anyway, You might.
mean, we can talk about this actually. It's interesting. And just before we move on, I wanted to ask. So, Professor Lubinsky, I think, has told us that he heard about the replica trick from you, actually. So, do you remember how, what would have been the genesis of that interaction or the context?
I don't actually. I'm not. I certainly, remember knowing Tom. I don't remember exactly how or when, I would have told him about it, perhaps at a meeting. I think, again, I'm really not sure. Don't take this with a giant grain of salt, but I think I may have given a short talk at the APS, the big APS meeting, that year, maybe 1974, and may have talked to him there. I just don't remember the details of how I first talked to him.
And from what I could tell, actually, you've never used a replica trick again in your own work. Is that correct? And if yes, is there any particular reason why not?
actually, I haven't thought about that, but I think that's right. Probably never did. And I guess the context in which it could be used was somewhat limited. I mean, isn't it pretty much spin glasses where it's been used subsequently, or other things? I just don't remember.
Yes, and more.
There are different
Yes,
things for
there.
people. Really?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, interesting. Okay. And I guess, by the time spin glasses came around, which I never really worked on very intensively, it was broken replica symmetry that seemed to be the thing that people were interested in. And I really, I never really got into that. And I never really felt that I appreciated what people had done with it. I did make some attempt, but not a serious enough attempt. And there were a lot of complicated ideas going around at the time. I mean, Chaim Sompolinski, super brilliant guy, had all these ideas, which I always felt I was never quite fully understanding. That was probably before the broken replica symmetry came along. So yeah, I really, just never really worked intensively on a problem where it seemed relevant.
Did you follow the conversation about the breaking of replica symmetry, or this is a post facto, digging back through the literature? Were you reading or listening?
Not so much actually. I went to a few talks on the subject. I wasn't sure how much of it I believed, actually, but it wasn't a super expert opinion by any stretch of the imagination. I tried to read a couple of articles.
Do you recall any dates or times or people that you might have heard this from or read?
I don't, well, certainly the name, Giorgio Parisi is a name that I certainly remember in that context. And I remember meeting him actually in Italy at some point in, I'm trying to remember, but might have been in Florence when I spent a month there at some point in the 80s with, Roberto Livi and others, and I think that's where I first met him. And I have a feeling that he w was talking about that at the time, but again, the details are a little bit hazy in my mind.
So as you were alluding to earlier, you worked on the random field easing model and other disordered models afterwards. What were the questions you were pursuing at that point, or was a general program in a sense?
Well, general program, yes, but I think of particular interest, strange, it seems like such a small detail now, but people were absolutely fascinated with the question of what the lower critical dimension was for random field, well, Isaac in particular, but in general, random field models. because there'd been this early argument by I think it was Imran Ma, if I remember correctly, basically about domain walls, showing that very elegant, simple argument, which suggested that the lower critical dimension was two in those systems. And then I did a calculation, I think in 75 or something like that, which concluded that there was a dimensional reduction in the critical exponents. In other words, you could do an expansion around six, which was the upper critical dimension, and it turned out that the exponents you got were the same as pure system exponents in two lower dimensions, which suggested that suggested, although hardly convincingly, that three was actually the lower critical dimension, because one is the lower critical dimension for purizing systems. Anyway, this started kind of an industry, because by now the experimentalists had figured out ways to make good realizations of the random field problem with random antiferromagnets in a uniform field. And this great controversy arose because there were two main groups, as I remember it, doing this, the MIT group under Bob Birgeneau, and then there was a group in California under Vince Jacquarino. And these two were vigorously at odds. I think I hope I'm remembering this right. I'm thinking that the MIT group was arguing that DC equals three, the lower critical dimension was three, and therefore that you couldn't have true phase transitions in or below three dimensions. And the reverse by the California group was that, were they in Santa Cruz? I'm not even not quite remembering even the which of the UCs it was. And of course, this the experimental effort was complicated by the by critical slowing down, by severe critical slowing down. Everybody understands that now, but at the time, I don't think people understood how severely the dynamics could influence what you saw experimentally. That to try to get to the true equilibrium behavior could be extraordinarily difficult. But anyway, as I remember it, and I don't know if you're talking to either of those two guys, but there was so much hostility between those groups that lawsuits were threatened. At least that was the rumor that was going around over this issue. So people cared about this very passionately. And then I think at around that time, Shang Ma and I wrote a paper. I hope I'm right about that. Arguing that DC equals two was correct. And so we came in on that side of the debate, and eventually that turned out to be correct, as I remember.
And that was a paper with Jean Mazenko as well, right? Is that, or was that a different
Yeah,
one?
maybe, oh, was Mazenko on that paper too? Yeah, I'm sorry,
Dynamics of spins interacting with quench random impurities, is that what you're referring to in 1977?
Sorry, read me the title again, please.
Dynamics of spins interacting with
Oh,
quench random impurities.
no, this wouldn't have been dynamics. This was
Okay.
just purely talking about the statics, just the
Okay.
critter, whether there was a an ordered phase. I'll have to go back and get that reference for you. If it exists, maybe it's only in my head. Maybe it's one of those papers that should have gotten written. But I think, no, anyway, I'll go back and check.
If we jump a bit forward in time, in the mid 1980s, you worked on neural networks from a spin glass perspective, actually, with Sarah Sola and John Hertz. How did these ideas and this work come, this collaboration come about?
Oh right. My recollection is a little bit hazy, but it must have been because I was spending a fair bit of time in those days at Nordita in Copenhagen, where John was a professor. He and I had known each other for a long time, since his days at the University of Chicago. He and Jean Mazenko and Paul Horn, were the young guys I first met at the University of Chicago years earlier. Yeah, and so and I think and Sarah was actually also working in Copenhagen at that point. So I think that's how the collaboration got started. Exactly, the detailed or origin of the ideas and the discussions are really it's like kind of beyond me at this point. I really don't have a clear recollection of them.
Shortly afterwards, you co-authored a piece for Physics Today with Daniel Fisher and Anil Khurana that includes a discussion of spin glasses in particular. How did you come to work on this piece? Do you and how did this how did it happen, if you remember?
Well, Daniel was somebody I'd known really since he was a kid. I think I first met him when he was about to start graduate school, possibly at a meeting where his dad, Michael, was giving a talk, and he was, and part of the family was tagging along. That may have been the first time I met him. That's certainly how I met his younger brother, Matthew, was at one of these meetings. His brother Matthew was at IBM at that point, so I was, pretty friendly with those guys in general. And Daniel used to visit often. We would often chat. We were both interested in random magnets. So I think that's how the idea came about. I can't remember whether we were asked by Physics Today to write that article, or whether we suggested it to them. I just don't remember. But Anil Khurana was one of the editors of Physics Today at that time. So the idea may have come from him. The idea to do the article may have come from him.
I mean, did you have a particular opinion about finite dimensional spin glasses, or this was largely Daniel's contribution to that piece?
Well, it was largely his contribution. I certainly like those ideas of trying to think about the stability of ordered states in terms of droplets, and surface tensions, and in particular the idea of the dynamics being crucial because they would be logarithmically slow, given all the frustration in the system. I thought those ideas were actually quite fruitful, particularly if you were trying to understand experiments. So I was, very I was comfortable with those ideas. I don't know whether they have held up. I haven't followed you. You could tell me, but yeah. So I, he certainly played the leading role in writing that section of the paper, but I think we were pretty much in agreement on most of the physics that was written there. I think, later, as I think I mentioned to you in an email, one of my friends in the field said, "Hey, you guys, you really slighted there was a pretty significant French group who done a lot of work on spin glasses," and he said, "I think you could have done a much better job acknowledging their contributions." And in hindsight, I realized that was true. I really, should have taken a more a broader view of the field before writing that article. But, I apologize, guys. I think it could have it should have been included. I can't even remember the names of the guys we're talking about, but I know I slighted them. We slighted them.
At about the same time, you published what's considered a milestone work about boson localization with Matthew and Daniel Fisher. How did that come about?
Well, again, through IBM. Matthew was at IBM at the time. Daniel was visiting a lot.
But who
And
was
so
interested in the problem at first, or
I
was
think it was
exploring
Matt.
it?
It's really Matthew. It was really Matthew who was the driving force behind that paper, I would say. Yeah. And the rest of us were very interested, contributed here and there. But I think, as I remember it, Matthew was the driving force behind that paper.
During your time at IBM or elsewhere, did you ever teach about the replica trick or replica symmetry breaking or spin glasses in any context?
Well, not teach. I certainly gave lectures at conferences and, just visiting universities and stuff. Certainly gave lectures about random magnets early on, because by 19, thinking certainly by 1980, all of the interest had turned to glasses and spin glasses. And, I didn't feel I had that much to say about those subjects. But in the early days, or every once in a while there would be a review conference or something, talking about the good old days, and I would go and give a talk. But really it was mostly early on, when people were still trying to figure out what was going on with quench random systems.
Is there anything else you'd like to share about this this era that we may have missed or skipped over?
Not that comes to me right away, but actually after this conversation, you've also reminded me of other things which I hadn't thought about. So if something else comes to me, I guess I'll have the chance to get back to you, right?
In closing, do you still have notes or papers or correspondence from that epoch? And if yes, do you have a plan to deposit them in an academic archive at some point?
I doubt that I do, although I may hidden down in the basement somewhere, maybe some old notes. I certainly, had no plan to deposit them. I mean, is that would that be part of this archive? Are you thinking about that old, notes and stuff?
I mean, we can discuss the logistics after, but if you do have material, especially correspondence with others about the work, that could be of interest for sure.
The only thing I remember that I might have was a nasty letter I wrote somebody at some point. Not really nasty, but one of those letters to say, no, this cannot be right. I wonder if I still have that. That's the only thing that comes to mind that I might have kept, just because afterwards when I read it, I said, this was so stupid. Why did I write this letter? And this is before email. I think this is, couldn't have been before email. But anyways, one of those must have been email. One of those things where I said to myself, email is a disaster. It doesn't give you enough time to sit down and think before you send it off. But anyway, I can certainly have a look. I'm not sure I have anything, but I'll have a look.
Thanks, Dr. Hirschstein, for the conversation.
Very nice talking to you and meeting you. And yeah. Appreciate it.